Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers. Each week, you'll hear how they navigate these fulfilling and challenging roles, how they make art and mother their children. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and now podcast host. I hope these interviews inspire and encourage you on your own journey as an artist and mother. Thanks for listening.
You know, I think one of the things that I struggled with for a while was the kind of sense that if I was in the painting world telling somebody that I was a philosophy professor, there was sort of the immediate reaction, well, if you were really serious about painting, you'd just be doing that, and then the same thing the other way. And it's exhausting to hold the part in your life. And I think over time, I feel myself more at home with just being complicated. And it's the way I think. This is the way I live. And it happens to come in these different material forms. And more unapologetic about it, which has been really freeing and great.
Megan Craig is an artist mother living in the Northeast. She has a rich and diverse art practice, which began with painting and over time has evolved to incorporate performance work and textile-based work. Her paintings have been exhibited across the world, and she has been awarded residencies and grants from many prestigious places, including the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, the Vermont Studio Center, and the New York Arts Foundation. Megan is an associate professor of philosophy at Stony Brook University. And last but not least, she is the mother of two small-ish children. Megan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah. So if you'll start by kind of giving us, you know, just some bullet points, some high points along your journey as an artist. A lot of people jump into their childhood, if that was relevant to your practice, and, you know, bring us up to speed to where you are now.
Okay. Yeah, I think probably like many people who are artists, I did have a sort of childhood infatuation with making things and with colors, especially with colors. All my early memories seem to be tied to really intense color experiences. Mm. But I would say that I drew a lot and I did a lot of making of things, but I was never like the kid in the class that everybody thought that was so great, mm-hmm. or there's talent there. Mm. So for me, I think it was always, you know, I have a strong relationship to being a kid and a kind of self-talk or storytelling that would happen when I was making pictures that was very soothing to me and was really important to me. Mm. But I would say in terms of the idea of actually becoming an artist, it wasn't until I was well into high school. And I had one painting teacher when I was in high school. So I switched high schools when I was a junior, which was really kind of tricky for me emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I had a really amazing teacher who he was kind of wacky and encouraging. And it wasn't really like, you're so great at what you're doing, or that's a terrific painting.
Right.
But a level of interest in what I was making that was different mm-hmm. than I think what I had experienced before. But I really, so in my kind of early childhood and leading all the way up through high school, I was doing a lot of theater. So that was kind of like my first love. Mm. And then when I went off to college, I just discovered, I went to Yale as an undergrad.
Okay.
And really in the first days of being there, I kind of realized that the undergraduate theater scene there was not something that I really wanted to be in. And so I took this introductory drawing class and it was sort of like finding my people.
Mm.
And yeah, I think I never really thought that it was a viable thing for me to be doing.
Mm.
But it's sort of going through undergrad, and I double majored in philosophy and in I guess you can't technically double major, but I did all the requirements for the art major and the philosophy major. So I have a degree in philosophy, but the painting classes and that cohort of people that I was able to be with in those classes were really important to me. Mm-hmm. And it felt like real work to me in a way that not everything else did. Mm-hmm. So I would say even then, I didn't think it was viable for me to really be an artist.
Do you think that was like lack of exposure to just artists in your life? Or was that just like a generational thing? Or what do you think that was?
I don't know. I mean, I think it is tied to the fact that I didn't have any models in my family mm-hmm. of what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I would say both of my parents are incredibly artistic, but mm-hmm. in ways that have to do with, you know, just how they live and set up right. their house. My dad's always making stuff. My mom is kind of a genius with color. Mm. But yeah, I think that it was not a part of a reality that I really could understand, you know, practically, like mm-hmm. how would you actually make a living doing right. that? And I think part of it was sort of this foundational, like lack of belief in myself mm-hmm. and not, you know, having the experience that I've sort of historically in my life, I've always been the kid who like works really hard and mm-hmm. I get the most improved certificate at the end of things, but it's never like the, you know,
it comes easily.
It has not come easily yeah. ever. So I think, you know, I'm in a very different place now in relationship to that, but I think when I was still in college, it felt like there were two or three people in my painting class who were the talented kind of star mm-hmm. people. And so of course it seemed like, well, yeah, they'll go out and be artists and I'll get a job.
Right. So even if you were exposed to maybe some people who looked like they could make it, it was still just kind of the small few, like it wasn't a viable option for, say, everybody in your program. It was more like a small percentage of you, this is actually probably going to become a reality.
Yeah. You know, I think it was also tied to my experience at Yale. You know, the kind of class divide at Yale is really intense. And making art is really expensive. Being mm-hmm. in those classes was really expensive. So when I say that practically it didn't seem like a real option to just go out and be an artist, that was also a really nuts and bolts kind mm-hmm. of experience I was having, that I was collecting like wood that had been discarded on the street and, you know, trying to make things on these surfaces that were really interesting, but, you know, would not kind of hold up. And so it sort of intensified, I guess, a kind of feeling I had that I didn't really belong fully and that there just were kind of a set of options that either are available or aren't available. You have right. to find your way. Hmm.
So you decided then to major in philosophy also as kind of like this is my career and I'll continue with art, but maybe I'm not sure how I'm going to do that.
Well, it sounds so ridiculous, right?
No, I mean, it sounds like reality. I mean,
yeah, I think that probably everyone in my family was deeply perplexed because here I was painting a lot and then studying philosophy, and it was not clear that either of those things would lead to any meaningful employment ever. It was like, yes, practically I will study philosophy, but so it's funny because this has actually worked out. But no, I mean, I majored in philosophy. I kind of fell in love with aspects of philosophy. I also, honestly, when I was at Yale, it was painting and philosophy that for me were the hardest, most challenging things I was doing. And so I really felt like I was getting my money's worth.
Yeah, you knew you were pushing yourself.
Yeah. And I kind of, you know, I did not really enjoy undergrad. I did not have this gauzy, like, wish I could go back kind of experience. But it is a time where I just worked really, really hard. And I actually was teaching preschool through most of the time that I was in college.
What?
And I ended up doing a lot of painting, actually, of the kids in the preschool where I worked. And
okay.
So, you know, kind of, I was sort of always 1 foot in, 1 foot out, I guess.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, so you graduated from undergrad, and then what was the trajectory after that? Did you go to grad school for philosophy, or did you go get an MFA, or did you, like, kind of, how did the next step sort of unfold in terms of combining those two things, which now you have, like, figured out how to do that successfully, but, like, how did you get to that point?
So I moved to New York. I moved in with my sister, my older sister, who was already living there. And
this is post-undergrad, right?
Yeah, right after graduating.
Undergrad, okay.
Not knowing at all what I was going to do. And actually, so I cast around for quite a bit, feeling like I could not get a job to save my life. And really, all I actually wanted was a job that could support my painting. So applying for all these jobs, like, I remember trying to get a job selling Christmas trees.
Because it's seasonal.
Because it's seasonal. And I actually grew up on a farm that sold Christmas trees. So I was like, I actually have qualifications for this.
Right.
But I would look, you know, if I had to give them anything about what I'd done, they're like, you went to Yale? Like, no way.
And you want to sell Christmas trees?
Yeah. So it was very hard. But I started volunteering with this company called City Arts. And I worked on a really big mural in Chinatown as an assistant artist to a lead artist and with kids from the local public school down there. And that was a really beautiful, great experience. And then around that time, I started working at an art gallery, and I felt like I was I was living in this tiny little place that I was sharing with other people. So I was making these little paintings, and I applied to MFA programs and PhD programs in the same cycle. And that, I mean, I still think of that as this funny crossroads in my life, because I could have gone either way, but it was, again, this very stark financial decision where I could essentially go to get a PhD for free, and the MFA, I just couldn't justify the kind of feeling that I would be underwater for I didn't know how long.
Right.
And I just didn't know, honestly, how I would do it. So
a PhD in philosophy.
Yeah.
Were you thinking at that time that, like, actually maybe being a college professor would be a good career that you could, you know, also have a painting practice?
Yeah, I definitely felt like I was already painting. Like, I didn't really need the structure to make that happen. And I come from a family of teachers, like public school teachers.
Right.
That was a very known sort of career path and the rhythm that. So, I would say I definitely thought, well, here's one way I can sort this out. I'll be teaching philosophy, and then I'll be painting, which I kind of can't rely on getting paid to do, and rely on the fact that I'm going to keep doing it, that I don't need the kind of discipline from an external source to have me keep doing it.
So interesting. Okay. So now I would love for you to describe your work for maybe anybody who has never seen it, or, and I know that your work is pretty diverse in terms of medium, but maybe at least start with your painting, and then we can follow up with some of the more performance-based work or more current work.
Sure. So I think my work, my painting work, is really rooted in cityscape painting, which is something that I did for a bunch of years in New York City, and then continued even when I moved up to New Haven, which was, it was a funny transition because I kind of felt like I lost all my subject matter and had to try to seek it out again. But for me, in New York, painting the city was one way of both getting to know it and making it tolerable. And it opened up a kind of abstraction that I found really interesting. So I was looking at sort of cross sections of buildings and rooftops, and I don't know, it felt to me like there was something that matched between the kind of stroke that I wanted to be making and the shapes that I was finding in the architecture. So even now, I mean, now my painting is almost entirely abstract in the sense that I'm not looking at anything and it's not tied to any view. But I think there's still a kind of blocky architectural sensibility to the space in the paintings. And now I kind of feel like I have this sort of inventory of certain kinds of buildings or building shapes that have morphed more into like characters or I don't know. So for me, they feel more figural, even though I really have never painted the figure. So that's kind of the trajectory of painting. I mean, more and more in my painting life, I've treated my work like research projects where there's a set of ideas that I'm working with visually, and I generate a lot of different material around those ideas, and then a body of work that is really tied into, you know, whether it's a bit of text or whether it's, I don't know, it could be almost anything, but I feel like I have these very clear now kind of sets of paintings that are all circling around the same kind of idea.
I'm just curious because for me, that type of investigation, I learned that skill in my MFA program. I didn't really like learn that in my undergrad. So do you feel like that's something you just like sort of arrived at? I guess it would be in a way like contextualizing, you know, the work. Or do you feel like, because you never went on to do an MFA, right?
I didn't, no.
So I'm just interested to hear how you kind of arrived at that creative process. Because I'm assuming what this led you to was, and, you know, you can obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the more performance and textile-based work, like maybe you felt like painting wasn't getting you to where you wanted to go, and so you pushed yourself into other mediums. Is that how you arrived there?
Yeah, that's a part of it, definitely. I mean, so I think, first of all, there was a long period of time where I tried to really keep my studio practice and my writing and research as a philosophy professor very separate. And I would say it's like a long maturation process of letting those two things come closer together and be more complicated. And so the kind of research that I do when I'm writing an article or, you know, preparing a graduate seminar or something, that is very like known to me now. I know the steps that I will have to be going through and the kinds of revision and rewriting and all of that. And I think, so I think that's sort of a way that I think and that I like to think, and bringing that into the studio has been like a way of letting my thinking be more present in my work. For a long time, I think, you know, part of the cityscape painting even for me was about kind of silencing that super intellectual part of who I am and just, you know,
engaging.
So, yeah, I feel more comfortable now having ideas about what my work is.
And so, but maybe the research and investigation tactics, like, you know, intermingled with your painting practice as you like post your PhD program and like as you embraced your philosophy background a little more. I liked that idea of you letting the identities sort of like intermingle and letting those things, like rather than holding them apart from each other, like letting them kind of influence and benefit each other, you know, you as Megan as philosopher and Megan as artist.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that I struggled with for a while was the kind of sense that if I was in the painting world telling somebody that I was a philosophy professor, there was sort of the immediate reaction. Well, if you were really serious about painting, you'd just be doing that. And then the same thing the other way. And it's just, it's exhausting to hold apart in your life. And I think over time, I feel myself more at home with just being complicated. And it's the way I think. This is the way I live. And it happens to come in these different material forms. And more unapologetic about it, which has been really freeing and great, because I don't, well, it's just like, you know, you can imagine if you're trying to hold up two walls with both hands and then suddenly you just decide to let them lean.
Right.
Weight off your shoulders.
Yeah. Which, I mean, in a lot of ways was the reason that I was interested in starting this podcast, because, you know, for me and for many other artists, being a parent is one of those is one of those walls that you're kind of thinking that you're supposed to be holding up and keeping them separate, but eventually it just comes crashing down and it mixes. So I feel like that's a good place for me to transition into asking you a bit more about your journey as a mother and how that is related to your art practice or how it's not. Maybe you could talk about your kids a little bit and how the identity of mother fits into all of these other things that you do and are.
Yeah. So I have two little girls. My oldest is 9 and my youngest is 5. And I mean, I don't know if it's weird to say this, but I was completely ambivalent about having children, even though I, my whole life have worked with kids and worked in preschools and kindergarten teacher for a bit. And I love kids. I'm always the person at somebody's party who is somewhere with a child rather than talking to any adults. But I just never had that moment where I was like, I have to have my own kid.
Right.
And I was truthfully really nervous about it when I realized that I was pregnant, because I was not yet tenured. You know, it was at a kind of moment in my career that felt very, very intense. But yeah, it's the greatest thing that ever happened, of course. And I feel one of the things that is so striking about having my daughter, Cora, was, first of all, immediately as soon as she was born, I was just stupidly in love with her. But then my whole sense of time shifted pretty immediately, too, in the sense that pre-Cora, I would have told you that in order to make anything in my studio, like to have a time in my studio, I would need 4 hours. That was sort of set in my psyche as like, that's how long it takes to do the warm up and get into your work. And yeah, I can make something in 20 minutes if I have it now. So
I love it.
I just felt like this was a gift of efficiency. And, you know, of course it's crazy and there's too many expectations and there's never enough time. But I really feel like for me, it has been clarifying in the best possible way, because I really didn't realize how much time I was wasting.
So good. What about, do you feel like other than time, has there been any other points of challenge or contention to like being a parent and being an artist? Have you felt a lack of support, or do you feel like it's been pretty fluid?
I don't, it's hard to know where to start with that question. You know, there are of course so many challenges, and, I guess I feel really blessed to have a lot of friends with kids who I admire and whose kids I love in a community around us. You know, I think for me becoming a mother was really the first time that I felt myself doing a job that wasn't really, really hard for me, even though I find, you know, parenting really tricky all the time. And I know this is not a universal experience, but, you know, I think I've always in my life kind of worked, like overworked at things.
Right.
And so it was,
this came more natural, maybe.
Yeah. And it was sort of refreshing to feel like I didn't need to overthink this thing, that caring for this little person was not only my top priority, but it was something that I felt capable of doing. And that was a really nice surprise, because I did not know, you know, I didn't know if that would be the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in general, having kids has made me more confident and more, well, definitely also just, you know, I have less tolerance for a whole range of things.
Yeah.
Which has been really useful in my professional life to bring that over and be like, well, I just don't have the time for this or that.
Right.
Yeah. So I just feel super grateful about having them.
The Artist Mother podcast is growing, and I want you to be a part of this movement. Get involved, join in our conversations on Instagram, share your favorite episodes, and connect with artist mothers in your area. There are so many great things in store for our community. If this podcast has been a source of inspiration or encouragement to you, would you please leave us a review on iTunes or support our work by purchasing a t-shirt or tote for yourself or an artist mother you love? You can find our shop on our website, artistmotherpodcast.com. There are also full posts from each episode with lots of great photos you can check out. Thank you for coming alongside me as I work hard to share stories of artist mothers. I believe in you. Okay, Megan, talk to me about, I was going to ask you what a day in your life looks like, but I think it would be more appropriate to ask you what a week looks like because you're juggling, like you commute to Stony Brook for teaching, but then you have a studio practice in New Haven, right? Which those are two things are about like an hour or two away from each other. Maybe shorter, maybe longer.
Well, it's a funny commute. I mean, the commute really to Long Island, Stony Brook is, you have to kind of allow 3 hours one way.
Oh, so wow. Okay.
That is it, really.
So the laugh was like, if only it was 1 hour.
It was a little bit of that. Yeah. But that is that's one of the major challenges of my existence.
So what is, like, in terms of time and structure, and particularly like fitting in, you know, the mom and artist like roles, what does a week look like for you?
So this is the first year that my kids are both in school, in the same school, for a day that goes from 8:15 until 3.
Okay.
So that has been remarkable in our household because it's so much less kind of puzzle piece juggling of who's where and when.
Yeah.
So this year has been kind of, this last 2 years, I would say, have been kind of different because I am changing the balance between my teaching and philosophical work and my studio work and really prioritizing the studio above everything. So what I have learned for myself is that I need to have 3 days in the studio in order not to feel like I'm constantly just starting over when I show up to things. So that doesn't have to mean like an 8-hour day.
Right.
But it just, you know, I've also really expanded my definition of what counts as work and studio time. So basically I need to show up physically in this space. And then beyond that, I'm very generous with with myself about what has to happen.
Yeah.
So those are 3 days, and 2 days I'm really devoted to my teaching. I also end up so the bulk of my philosophical writing ends up happening after the kids are asleep. And I find, first of all, you know, I don't need a lot of space for that. And I can do it from home.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a way in which having them in their beds where I know where they are frees up the kind of brain space that I need for that kind of work.
That makes sense.
So that can start to feel really like burning the candle at both ends.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say generally it's sort of like I have different projects and they kind of sap me in different ways. And then I have these sort of recovery periods where I'm not trying to meet a deadline.
Right. What about, it seems like you do a lot of like gallery shows and like extensions of your studio practice outside of like your art. It seems like your art is very present in your community and outside. And I know that requires a lot of work and detail administration stuff. Do you have somebody helping you with any of that? Or is that like what you mean by when you spend 3 days in the studio, like a half of one of those days might be, you know, making those calls or like all of that admin stuff?
Yeah. So I do have somebody who helps me out in a very ad hoc kind of way. Like if there is a project, then, you know, I might have like a list of 15 or 20 things and Kyle and I will try to sort them out. But I feel like I really learned so much about the administrative side of the art world when I was working at a gallery. And I guess I've always, you know, sort of from the beginning of my painting life, I've been really organized and just sort of adopted some of those habits from this gallery where I worked for my own practice, which, you know, for years and years really seemed kind of ludicrous because that was a very high-end gallery that I worked at. And so to treat your own work that way is sort of, you know, you have this cognitive dissonance about it.
Right.
But I definitely got some very good skills in that time period. And having, you know, just things like having a good database inventory of the work that I have, having things organized in the studio, I know where things are and where I need to send them. And then for the public projects that I do, where it's kind of a participatory, like public artwork project, I really love that kind of coordination and setting up situations where actually everybody else is making the work. And I've just sort of put in place the...
You set the parameters.
The parameters.
Yeah.
So I don't really... That's not stuff I delegate because I really, really love...
You like that.
Nice. ...aspect.
I would love for you to just talk to us a bit about some of the recent shows that you've had and your jump from a more like traditional painting practice to, you know, performance and textile. I've the show that in particular that I'm thinking of that I feel like you've been sharing images from recently are the capes and, you know, the more like, I think there were some fabric pieces on the ground in the studio that I saw. Could you maybe talk about some of that work and what it's been like to transition to like textile-based work and that recent show?
Sure. So I should have said this earlier maybe, but really the kind of impetus for starting to do some performance work was being pregnant and realizing that I really didn't feel good about using oil paint while I was pregnant. And I did not feel great about just using some other paint because that was so much my medium. So I kind of tried acrylic and, you know, I did a bunch of stuff with acrylics and watercolors and other things, but I felt like this was an opportunity to really expand my practice in a way that would be challenging and uncomfortable for me. So I started collaborating with a dancer friend of mine named Rachel Burnson. And we went on to do, I think, 5 different performance pieces together. And in the midst of making that work, I started doing some work with textiles, like sewing the costumes or...
Well, and you have that background in theater a little bit, so...
Right. It sort of brought a bunch of those different things together. And I really... You know, it was funny when I started sewing, I was like, I have no idea how to sew, although I learned as a kid. But it was very liberating because as I started doing it, I just felt like, well, it's sort of like painting. Like you just rip it out. If it's working this way, you try it this way. And so it sort of demystified, you know, especially garment construction, whereas, you know, it only had to hold up for a couple of performances. So I could make pretty much anything to do that. So then I had a show lined up at Real Artways, which is a venue here in Connecticut in Hartford. Okay. And I really wanted that to be an immersive environment that had some participatory elements. Mm-hmm. And I had thought that it would be painting, but I was working with the idea of shields over the last couple of years and really started thinking about the possibility for a shield that is malleable and lightweight and not this kind of ancient armor, heavy, impenetrable thing, which I, you know, it felt to me like I was trying to envision something like a feminist shield as all the sort of agility and malleability of, you know, a woman's sensibility for what it means to protect and to be protected. So I started making these paintings, and they just, you know, it felt so much like the wrong kind of shield materially. And I had all this fabric lying around from different performance works that I had done. So I just started sewing these things, which I wanted to be kind of multi-use. Like, you could put them on the wall, or you could drape them around your shoulders, or it's a blanket, or it's a tent. And in the course of that, there were several people kind of in my life surrounding, you know, some very close, some a little bit more distant, who were going through some really difficult things. So I wanted to make them shields that would sort of highlight the way in which their struggle could be kind of alleviated or made to feel different by, first of all, making something beautiful for them, but then in the exhibit, having multiple people wear these garments. Because for me, I think the idea of sharing the garment was like a way of sharing the weight of the things that they were facing. And so, and these were also kind of camouflage garments. So I made these capes that kind of intersected with the other fabric work with the idea that if you were in the gallery wearing one of these, you kind of disappear for a minute or as long as you want to stand still, I guess. And that for me felt like an important way of thinking about protection, which is always contextual. Like, you, there is no sort of single shield for everything. Right. Yeah, so highlighting that sort of vulnerability and making the show itself this moment of respite where it's possible to not only be with the work, but to be the work.
I love that. Man, I wish I had been there and seen it. Do you have video of it?
You know, I'm not sure I took any video of the show. I have lots of images of people wearing the work.
And the images are great, but it would be interesting to see some of the video, but maybe in a future show.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, since you do spend time commuting, I was wondering, and because your life is, like, your week is, like, broken up into those different sections, do you ever have ideas for things that, you know, you're just not able, like, how do you process, like, you're on a train and you have this, like, great idea for, say, sewing a cape or making a painting. Do you carry a sketchbook or do you take notes on your, like, phone? Or how do you, you know, when that muse comes and creativity, you know, strikes, how do you capitalize on that?
Yeah, so I never go anywhere without a little Moleskin book. And that's where I do that kind of jotting down. When I'm really in a project, I usually have a sketchbook just for that project that I don't go anywhere without. But I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that I have a lot of commuting to do, but most of it is not driving time.
Right. It's kind of thinking time.
Yeah. So I've developed a lot of habits of writing longhand and kind of capturing that time for a lot of my work, which has been really great. That's also changed the way that my work, well, especially my written work, the way that it sounds and that it feels. Actually, I just co-wrote an article with a colleague of mine called Thinking in Transit, which is about how when you're thinking and you're in motion at the same time, how that affects the quality of the thought.
Be interesting to read that.
But yeah, I draw, I mean, I think part of, I draw all the time and take down these notes with ideas. And the fabric work has been interesting because I actually feel like for the first time, the kind of sketchbook life that I've always lived is coming closer to what the work ends up looking like.
Oh, interesting.
Which was very rare for me with painting, where the painting kind of takes on this life of its own, that even right. if it had any relation to the sketchbook, it's now very
a
far.
A different thing, yeah. Hmm. Okay, I'm going to ask you like probably one or two more questions and then we'll wrap up. Just hearing you talk about the most recent show, I would love to know like what is kind of next for you this year? What are you working on right now? Or what is there anything in your art career that you're hoping to achieve this year or, you know, in the future? Or maybe there's something that you already are beginning to work on.
Yeah, it's funny. There's sort of residue from that show. There were things that I wanted to make that I didn't have time to make. Mm-hmm. So I'm still working with those ideas. It's like that body of work hasn't closed down yet. Mm-hmm. But I have a couple of projects in the works that are more public performance kind of projects. So one I'm thinking about actually for the community at the school where my girls are, that will be a kind of participatory work where we're going to make a sort of visual path through one part of the school. There's a lot of different rules and like different things related to how that path gets made. But mm-hmm. that's something that I'm working on now. And then I'm working on a project about memory that I'm just starting to get the pieces together for, but thinking about memory and editing and working with a population at a retirement home here in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. To try and create a sort of theatrical work around the ideas of memory and editing. Hmm. So those are sort of the public things in the kind of on the horizon. And then, mm-hmm. yeah, in the studio, I'm casting about right now for the next real body of work. I think I'm still in the last one a bit.
Hmm. Nice. What about for your family? Is there anything just as a mom that you're looking forward to? Do you have any plans for the summer or, you know, what's kind of on the horizon for your family this year?
Yeah. So I'm going to be a visiting artist for a week in Italy this summer.
Wow.
So, Nick and the kids are going to come over kind of at the tail end of that. So we're going to do a little bit of gallivanting and exploring around.
Nice. That's exciting.
Yeah. It should be really great. We've done quite a bit of travel with them, mostly because of places I have to be that then mm-hmm. we turn into a trip. And I just love traveling with the kids. It's mm-hmm. really great.
Mm-hmm. And great for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Megan, this has been really great to get to know you more and hear about your creative practice and your work. I want to close with just five questions that you can answer as briefly as you like, but just a way for us to get to know you a little better. So I would love to know, what are you currently reading? Maybe outside of philosophy.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is going to be very boring. I have been reading this book called Women at Work, which is a compilation from the Paris Review of interviews with different female authors. Mm-hmm. So that's been my kind of non-philosophical reading over the past couple of weeks. And it's a beautiful book.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. Sounds good. Okay, do you watch TV? Is there any show that you're currently following or watching?
So I don't really watch TV, but sometimes in the evening, we'll watch an episode of something. So we recently watched this series called The Detectorists.
That was good.
It's about metal detectors in
England.
And
interesting.
I can't watch anything that's too graphic or scary, or I have a mind that will not stop if I have that in my head when I'm trying to sleep. So this is a really lovely kind of slowest show in the world sort of show.
Nice.
Beautiful cinematography.
The Detectorists?
The Detectorists.
Cool. Okay, what would you do if you had a whole weekend to yourself?
So I feel like for me, that's kind of a trick question, because I would take my kids cross-country skiing or on a hike I would be outside for the whole mm-hmm. weekend if I could with
your girls,
with my girls and mm-hmm. with Nick.
That's good. I like that. Okay. What is your beverage of choice?
Probably white tea.
White tea. I don't know if I've had white tea. Yeah, I guess I have. Is that floral?
It can be. I think it's a little less caffeine than green. So yeah. It doesn't, I'm very sensitive to caffeine, so I can't really do like coffee at all. But yeah.
White tea. I'm going to have to try that. Okay, Megan, last question. I always offer just a time for you to share if there's somebody like a mentor or a big supporter in your life that you wanted to either thank or just say something about. I think it's nice to remind ourselves that community is important and, you know, sharing who we're grateful for is something that I think is just a good practice. So is there anyone that you want to give a shout out to?
My gosh. You know, as I was thinking about this interview and these questions, I was going through all these women who I adore, who are in my life, who are moms or who are artists. So there are so many of them. I don't know. It's hard to know where to start.
Yeah. But even just like stating anybody who's been a mom and artist who you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of my best friends from grad, Kat Balco, is an amazing painter and a mom of two boys, which gives us a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
And, amazing mom here whose kids are friends with my kids. Krista Doran she actually runs a gym here in New Haven, but I think of her as an artist all the time anyway. Mm. Yeah. And like I said, I feel just so much gratitude to women I know who are moms and who are not moms, who I'm just amazed by people's ingenuity and courage and the ways that people like live joyfully with so much that they have to deal with.
Yeah. I like that. It's a good way to end. And I think we should give a public shout out to Caitlin Woolsey who connected us. So
yes.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Caitlin. And mother. Yeah. Thinker.
Yes.
Poet.
Okay. So where can we find you? Are you on Instagram? What's your website? Let people know where they can look up more about your work and you.
So my website is my name, megancraig.com. And I am on Instagram at Water Street Projects.
Yeah. What is Water Street Projects? Is that just a name for your own studio practice or do you... run a gallery? We should have talked about that, but.
Yeah. You know, so there are two parts of this. One is that I'm very wary of social media. Hmm. So at some point it seemed like better to not have my name, to have to be sort of anonymous, but clearly that's a bad decision. But anyway, that's what it is. But the other thing is I was working on a mural and I had to rent a lift and it was super annoying to deal with the people at this lift company without having a kind of business, like as a business owner to rent a lift. So every time I would go in there, I would sort of get static from these guys about, oh, it's Megan Craig who wants a lift for Megan Craig. So I was like, you know what? No, I'm going to be Megan Craig who wants a lift for Water Street Projects.
So did that help?
It helped a huge amount. So I just feel like, you know, you just make the adjustment. So that's all it is that's the name of my studio.
Interesting. Well, that's good to know. And all because of a lift.
All because of a lift. Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks Megan for taking the time. This has been great to get to know you and your work and I appreciate you sharing with us.
Thank you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.